following is Kim Beeler's talk, From Flab to Fab, Design Secrets for Overweight Interfaces, from the 2011 Information Architecture Summit. The 2011 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's User Experience Training Library, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. Hear the field's top experts on timely topics and the current design challenges you're facing. Get a free UIE virtual seminar at uie.com/IAS11.
I want to introduce you to Kim Beeler. She's the owner of Apt Media in Silver Spring, Maryland. Not Silver Springs, as people tend to think. It's Silver Spring, Maryland. Her background is in print design, and she moved comfortably and casually into interaction design. And now, as far as I know, Apt Media does both. So everything she learned before, she is expert at applying. And I know you're going to love the presentation. Kim Beeler.
Thanks, Dave. You going to hit the lights? This is a visual design talk, so the slides are way more important than me. So if you have a laptop or an iPad, I encourage you to actually go to SlideShare and follow along on your device, because I think you'll have a slightly better experience. We're also dimming the lights so you can see these better. And you might want to move up, too. So thank you for coming in this early. It's nice to see everybody here. I'm going to start by talking about what I mean by overweight interfaces. You guys came here to see some design for overweight interfaces. What are those? Well, obviously what I'm talking about are interfaces that have a lot of content. And specifically, I'm thinking about interfaces that have a high density of content, where space is at a premium, and you're trying to put a lot of information in front of users all at the same time. Examples of this might be home pages, dashboards, transactional sites, sometimes your search results with a lot of filtering, enterprise apps, and even brochure sites where, for whatever reason, everything has to be above the fold. Now, IAs and visual designers can have a lot of problems with these kind of interfaces. For one thing, you could literally run out of space to put stuff. You also run the risk of presenting the user with too many choices and making things hard to find. The wireframes generated for these interfaces can be very intimidating, and the interfaces themselves can be hard to design. When we're constrained in the amount of space that we have to work with, it makes it hard to use techniques like white space and contrast, and these are some of the things that visual designers use to make interfaces more pleasurable and more understandable. Last but not least, let's face it, these aren't necessarily the most sexy projects that we're going to work on. And we might be feeling a little bit like we're not going to give it our best effort because it's not going to end up in our portfolio. Now, I hope that none of you came here today expecting to find out how to slim down your interface and put it on a diet, because I'm not talking about that. I don't actually care how your interface got that fat. What I am going to help you do is find a flattering corset, a foundation garment that will put curves and muscles in all the right places. What I'm going to do is show you 5 design secrets that will help you get the most out of your overweight interface. The first secret is to love your interface. Well, why would I even bring this up? The original title for my talk, when I was sort of working it out and figuring out what I wanted to talk about, was how to cram 10 pounds of crap into your 5-pound interface. And that's not a really very nice way of talking about these things. I mean, just because something is fat doesn't mean it can't be attractive. And there is beauty in these overweight interfaces. We just have to work a little harder to bring it out. Of course, that's easy to say, but you know, as I mentioned, there are plenty of reasons why you might not love your overweight interface. For one thing, it will never look like this. This is one of those sites I found on Best of the Web galleries. It's pretty typical, the kind of thing that we designers just go crazy about. We love this stuff. And why not? I mean, look at it. It's dark, it's sexy, it's conceptual, it's got these 5 inscrutable icons instead of boring old language-based navigation. And if this is the standard of beauty, well then how is our dense, content-heavy interface ever going to match up? Now, I tend to feel, and maybe you agree with me, that this site looks a little underfed. It's a little like one of those runway models. You know, beautiful face, nice clothes, but kind of lacking in character. Content is character. Sites with content are the ones that users return to over and over. And we need to remind ourselves of that and not feel jealous or envious of these skinny sites just because they have it easy. Now, a dense interface that does get a lot of love is the New York Times website. Jared talked about that quite a bit the other day. This is easy to love because it's already designed. But it's not obvious how you get to this when you start off with something like this. Now, obviously, I don't know what the wireframe for New York Times website looked like or if they even had a wireframe. But you might be feeling intimidated. You know, you might not be able to love your interface because you're too intimidated by it. And when you're intimidated, you tend to do timid design. And what you can end up with is an interface that's wearing the visual design equivalent of the Snuggie. Now, I know a lot of you guys love your Snuggies. But let's face it, you wear this when you're sick because you don't care if you look like a shapeless sack when all you're going to do is sit on the couch watching reruns all day. Now, your interface doesn't have this luxury. It's always out in public. You can't put a bag over its head and hope nobody sees it. You really have to give it the attention it deserves. And there's a few other situations where we might not love our interface, where we might fall out of love with it. What about those projects that just run out of control? You know, you have one of those clients, they want to put every single thing on every page, whether it belongs there or not, and you lose ownership of the design. Or what about the case where your wireframes are going straight to programming, and there's no designer in the middle, and you know they're just going to make a complete dog's dinner out of it? What we need to remember in these situations is that everything we do is in service of the project. So resenting your interface because it got fat or because you can't control what happens to it downstream is not going to help the user. We can't give up on these projects if they're not as perfect as we'd like. So why should you love your interface? Because it's never too late to improve the outcome. It might be too late to improve the IA or to fix the database or to fix the interactions. But you can always improve the user experience with better visual design. And I'm going to get into the meat of how to do that now. When I start working on complex interfaces, I always start with color. And the best way to tame your interface is to start with a neutral base color and build a set of tints off it. Because nothing makes your site look fat like too many colors. This is so bad, it's almost good. It's kind of mesmerizing. A site that does this really well is CNET. What they've done is they picked this base color of dark gray and they built a set of tints off it. We're going to look right now at how they do that. So they start off with this dark gray and they're using that for the text and that reverse bar in the middle. Then they've got a lighter gray that they're using in the navigation bar and that gradient. A still lighter gray for the divider rules and the navigation text. And then a very light gray for their text boxes. And then they use a nice calm blue for links, not that nasty fluorescent default blue from the browser. This looks pretty good, right? But maybe it's a little flat with all those gray tints. So this is how CNET kicks it up a notch. They've got this strong, vibrant accent color that they're using in a limited way, but in a meaningful way to really pick up the design and enliven it. Now, when I say neutral colors, neutral tints, I don't necessarily mean gray. This is a site I designed that uses purple as the base color and orange as the accent. And color theory tells us why this works. Cool colors, which you might associate with a cloudy day, tend to recede, whereas warm colors, which would be colors you'd see on a bright sunny day, tend to advance. So when you're using this technique in your design, you're literally creating elements, those accent elements that are jumping off the page or jumping off the screen at the user. Now, there's a couple of things you want to keep in mind when you're doing this, when you're using these accent colors. The first one is you do not want to overuse it. As soon as you overuse it, the effect is lost. You know, it's like that kid in school always had his hand up saying, pick me, pick me, pick me. And after a while, the teacher just learns to ignore him. And because these accent colors are so strong, it's very easy for the design to become lopsided if you don't use it in a balanced way. Additionally, we want to think about what's the meaning of the elements that we're using this color for, because they're very strong and they're like an arrow, so we want to direct people's attention to the content that is the important content that we want them to see. So I want to look at a couple of examples. This is a site that, well, they've got their strong accent color. It's quite good. It's really jumping off a page at you. They're using it in a restrained way. They've got good meaning associated with it, so they're using it for the call to action and their offers. But the page, because that red is so strong, the page is starting to list to one side. It feels a little lopsided. So we could fix this by introducing red into the navigation area, into the logo. So now we're creating a triangle. We've got a more balanced feel. The other reason this works is because eye tracking studies tell us that people tend to start looking at an interface in the top left corner and then do a kind of an F shape. So what we're doing is we're establishing that color in the top left where users first see the page, and then we're paying it off later on in the screen. So it's setting up an expectation and paying it off. And it's also creating this effect of drawing the user into the rest of your content. So Expedia has that yellow accent color in their logo, but it's not strong enough to set up that expectation. So what they've done here is they've used it just across their navigation, and then they're paying it off in those yellow buttons below. Now I want to go back to CNET really quickly and just look at how they are using that red accent. It's pretty restrained. I think they did a nice job on the navigation and in the content area. When we get to that right column, things are starting to fall apart a little bit. I mean, are those headings really that important, those box headings? I mean, isn't the content inside them more important? What about those quote marks? Isn't the quote itself more important than the quote marks? And yet those quote marks are kind of floating out there and they're really drawing your attention. And they don't mean anything. So I took a little stab at this, a little quick stab on that right column. Basically what I did was make the quote bigger and use one giant quote mark to draw attention to it. We don't really need to have both of them in red. And then I dropped all those headings back into gray so they recede instead of coming forward. Now, interestingly, when I did that first screenshot of this site, I went back a few weeks later and somebody had the same idea as me. They changed it. So you can decide which one you like better. So these are the things you want to remember about color. The interesting thing is that, of course, a good designer, a great designer, can use any number of colors and make the interface work. But if you're feeling intimidated and you're not sure where to start, then this technique is pretty foolproof. Next, I want to talk about anchoring the page with visual design. I want to talk about creating a strong anchor element. And what that is an element on the page that is bigger and stronger, more colorful than everything else. What it does is it tells the user where to look and what to care about. We'll start with a counterexample. So this is Morningstar website. They've done a pretty good job with dense content. There's a lot going on here. It's fairly easy to read. They've, you know, used some nice tabbed boxes on top to layer in more content. But where did you look first? The little charts in the middle? They're in the middle. What about the face? We have a bias to look at faces. Maybe you looked at the logo. It's in the top left. It's red. It's got some space around it. Don't leave me guessing about what's important on your interface. To me, this is an example of snuggy design. It's kind of timid and it doesn't commit. I want to look at a site that does this really well. This is a Brookings Institution website designed by 3Spot Media in Washington, D.C. They've done a really nice job with their neutral tints, and there's quite a lot going on here, but it's nicely organized. But right smack in the middle is that photo and that giant headline. So what that does is that anchor element of the photo or the headline, it creates a visual resting place. So it's the first place your eye goes when you look at the screen, when you look at the interface. And what it does is it helps organize the whole design. So even that stuff on the right makes more sense when you have that strong anchor. it seems like all the other elements kind of fall into place, like a well-trained army around its general. And the anchor element anchors not only design of the page, but also the meaning. It tells the users, what are we about? Now, the things to keep in mind when you're doing this is placement, of course. We have a bias to think that things at the top of the page are more important than the ones at the bottom. So obviously, you're going to put your anchor element towards the top. But the really important thing is contrast. When we have these overweight interfaces, they have a lot of content in them. The type is usually really small. Everything gets really small because we're trying to cram so much stuff in there. But the success of the anchor element depends on making something big. And it's actually worth making other things smaller so that you can make your anchor element bigger. I'm going to go back to Morningstar and just see if we can apply that technique that Brookings used to improve this layout. So what if we turn that first story and make it into a feature? You know, it's funny. I knew this would work when I did it, but I was still shocked when I saw how well it worked. So suddenly the design makes a lot more sense. Even that stuff on the right that looked a little bit random before, it just falls into place. And even though that's not a very interesting photograph, it's just some dumb stock image and the headline's not very exciting, it still works as an anchor element because it's still a place where you first come when you see the page, you start off there, and then you can just understand the rest of the page. And in fact, I didn't even lose any copy doing this. This was the original. We had three equal-sized stories. Now we have one big story and two smaller stories. You may also notice I used that red accent color in the headline to draw that color down into the page and start to unify the design a little more. If you're feeling really encouraged by this, you could keep going and really fix it. You know, just sort of put in more of your neutral tints, clean up all that crap at the top, and maybe put another call to action in your accent color later on in the page. In transactional applications or transactional sites and applications, you're not going to stick a big photograph in the middle of the page. Clearly, that's not going to happen. And so in these kinds of interfaces, your focus should be on tasks. And so in this case, I saw Boone here. He sent me this interface. Awesome. I'm going to clean it up for you, Boone. I come here and I want to book a hotel room, but I have to hunt around to figure out like where I should start. This is what they want me to do. It's right here. It's in the middle. It's in a box. But there's so much white space, and it's so disorganized. And in fact, there's way too many choices in here. There's nothing compelling about this. It doesn't look important. So we might do something like this. I created an anchor element around the most common task. I used my accent color to help that element pop off the page a little bit more. I actually took some liberties and simplified the choices. I sort of figured everything could be under more choices. I also put a big sexy button, because honestly, big sexy buttons are awesome. They really work. So what this is doing is it's telling me what to do. This interface is not waiting for me to figure out what I should be doing here. It's just telling me. And again, you know, if we wanted to go the whole hog, I'd probably try to unify that central element and make the anchor element pop even more by making everything else recede a little bit, just tighten the whole thing up. Now, you guys probably already know this. I mean, this isn't rocket science. But the fact is, you know, we see a lot of interfaces that don't have anything like an anchor element. They don't prioritize the content in such a way as to create that strong visual anchor. And there's a lot of reasons why that might be the case. You might have an unskilled designer, or you might not have a designer at all. You might just have a programmer. But in my experience, this is more likely due to an organizational problem. So you might have a situation where it's just bad politics to feature one program or one department or one product over another. Or you might be working with somebody who is convinced that users want a lot of choices, and so we should really put everything in front of them all at once and let them choose. Sometimes it's the case that the organization itself doesn't really know what it stands for, and so it's really hard to prioritize content when you're not really confident that you want to put yourself out there. So how do you get clients to prioritize the content to create this anchor element when they're unwilling or unable to do so? So if your problem is a political one, then you've always got the old trusty slideshow. I mean, it's working for DOD, and you know those guys have turf wars. So, or you could do a rotating feature that updates weekly or on refresh or something like that. But if they can't or won't prioritize the content, here are a few tactics. You could show them a compelling makeover like this and explain why this one's better. You could also do testing on two different designs and see which one works. If you're dealing with the sort of stakeholders or clients who really want to put a lot of choices in front of the user and think that, you know, we need to show them everything that we do on the homepage, you could appeal to authority. Inmates are running the asylum. Alan Cooper has a really good point about personas. And he says, if you want to create a product that satisfies a broad audience of users, logic will tell you to make it as broad in its functionality as possible to accommodate the most people. Logic is wrong. You will have far greater success by designing for a single person. And his example is the Dodge Ram pickup truck. They did a focus group, and 80% of the people hated it, but the other 20% loved it so much. It was so perfect for them that it was a huge success for the company. This is kind of a counterintuitive principle, but we can see it at work in the direct mail catalog industry. This is a spread from Uncommon Goods catalog, and it's a small format, and it's got, usually it's like 5 or 6 items on a spread and a little blurb about each one. And this is known somewhat disparagingly in the catalog industry as a treasure hunt catalog, because you have to flip through every single page to find something you like. And in fact, this philosophy carries over to their website, which looks like a flea market. Now let's look at what the big boys are doing. This is a sample from the L.L. Bean catalog. Do you think L.L. Bean would waste all this real estate on two products if it didn't work, if it didn't sell more? This is a very mature industry. These guys have metrics on everything. They calculate ROI literally on every square inch of every page of these books, and they do tons of A/B testing. So, compared to the treasure hunt, this is what's known in the industry as a hero image or a hero shot, because it's really big, it's really sexy, you can really see the product, and it moves a lot of merchandise. And of course, their website is the same way. They don't ask you what you want, they tell you what you want. And in fact, they're not even selling the shirt, they're selling the experience of wearing the shirt. These guys are good. So the anchor element can serve not only a visual role, but a persuasive role. So these are things to keep in mind when you're thinking about creating that strong anchor element. The thing is, this will work for any interface, but it's particularly important in our overweight interfaces because we really need to tell users where to look and what to care about. And the other thing is that prioritizing the content, choosing that element, really forces you to decide who you are and what you stand for. And even if what you stand for doesn't appeal to every user, it's still better to stand for something than for nothing. So this is worth fighting for. So the more dense your interface, the more you need boxes and containers and things like that to organize everything and control it. And in fact, content management systems are kind of forcing us into this model. And you can end up with things like the brick wall interface. So this is a pretty common thing we see nowadays. The problem with this is that, you know, it's a bunch of bricks with a prominent mortar line between them. All the content is in these little separate islands that are kind of floating in space. And it's not a very efficient use of space, at least horizontally. And the other thing, especially in this sort of design, is you can lose the sense of figure and ground so that the mortar lines can start to come forward and your text and your content starts to recede. You definitely don't want that. Yeah, these things are everywhere. And I got to say, they are infinite in their hideous variety. There is an efficiency in stacking boxes like this. Like you say you have a bunch of columns and you're just stacking up boxes inside them. But you can see how you develop problems. Like the strong repeating element, that reverse header that they have in these boxes. I mean, our brains want to find a pattern. So we're going to look at that and we're just going to try to connect all those headers. It doesn't really make a pattern that means anything. And those headers start to sort of leap out at you and they become all you can see. So this is a site I designed for Beacon Fire Consulting a year ago, and it's excessively boxy. I pretty much had to use every trick I know to take the curse off the boxes. So I just want to walk you through some of those techniques so you can see what I did. So one thing is I ran those boxes flush, right? I don't want to have that mortar line between all my boxes. So I'm just literally kissing them right up next to each other. And where I am using rules to separate out content or columns, they're very light in color and they're one pixel. The tint boxes that I'm using, I just do a tint, no rule around them. And that saves a lot of visual noise. I also threw in some drop shadow boxes. These are nice. They're borderless boxes with a little like 3-4 pixel drop shadow. You don't want to go crazy with the drop shadows in these interfaces because you just don't have enough space to do that. These are nice because they create a little bit of a raised effect, so some of those boxes are starting to come off the page a little bit, and they have a nice soft edge to them. And then the other thing I did was create some horizontal terraces to try to organize the content a little bit and put a little horizontal grid in there. What we're doing here is reducing the visual noise by softening and eliminating rules and boxes. So in the first example, we've got this black rule around the type, and it's kind of jumping out at you, and the type's kind of receding. And you can see how much space I have to put around each element, how much white space, just to make it legible. In the second example, I lighten the box, and you can see now how I can run that text a little closer to itself. And this is really important in our overweight interfaces, right? We're trying to cram a lot of stuff in here, but we need it to be legible. And the last example, I took the box away altogether, put dotted rules, and in fact, I lost those little triangle bullets. Repeating elements like bullets and arrows and things that don't do any work, they are visual noise. Get rid of them. So let's go back to health data and try to use some of these techniques on this site to improve it. So the first thing I'm going to do is go into that navigation and just use that technique I just showed you with the dotted lines and took away the bullets. Then I'm going to go into that center column. Actually, what I did here was took that registration box and used the accent color for the text instead of for the whole box and just softened that box. And also made a sexy button because I love sexy buttons. So this is where we started. This is where we are now. You might notice that one of the effects of this, of taking away the boxes and the boxiness, is that I'm putting more elements into what I call the ground layer. If you think of an interface as having layers, where you're sort of layering things in, there's a bottom layer. And my feeling about this kind of design is that things that are in boxes should be features. They should be special. Like, they should be the exception and not the rule. And the other thing about it is if you start from the ground layer, you have more headroom in your design. You can layer in more things. Like, you're starting from a lower point. Does that make any sense? You're going to be layering in a lot of things, but you don't want to start in the middle. So then I'm going to tackle these sort of funky boxes on the right. I want to talk about this a little bit. In a lot of interfaces, we end up with one column, usually the leftmost column, that is kind of the catch-all column for all the weird stuff that we didn't know where else to put. And so there can be a lot of unrelated things in this column. There's a couple ways you can treat this. You can either give them all exactly the same treatment, which I tend to feel is a little boring. And also, they're not really the same things. You might want to mix it up and try something different. So these are some examples of ways that you can use different box styles for that sort of weird third column or last column that has all the funky, unrelated content in it. You can change the background color of the box. You can change the shape of the box. You can do rounded corners instead of square corners. You can put things in the ground, and you can put some of them in another layer, do a little drop shadow or something like that. You can put some dimensionality in the box. So you've got flat boxes and kind of dimensional boxes. These are good techniques to kind of mix things up and make the design a little bit more interesting so it's not so monotonous. So I want to just look quickly again. Here's our before. And here's where we are now. So we've come a long way, I think. But now that I've taken out most of the structure, I want to actually put a little bit back in. So if we think of this layout as being a bunch of boxes, it's an efficient way of doing this, but it feels disorganized. It doesn't have a lot of visual organization to it. So what I want to do is I want to actually create some of this horizontal terracing inside the layout to help people understand what's going on. And this is a good example of a site that does this. You can see that it's a little bit less efficient because if you have a horizontal grid, your columns can be uneven and then you can have some white space in there where there's not actually anything in it. So you do need to control the amount of content in these things so that, you know, your columns don't get totally lopsided. But I think it adds so much coherence to the design that's actually worth taking that chance that you're not using every single pixel. So here we are back where we left off in the design. And this is what it looks like with a little bit of terracing in it. And the other interesting thing about this is that you can use the horizontal terracing effect to put like content with like. So for example, the more news links and the most read and most emailed are on the same layer. And then I put the slideshows and conference stuff and things you're going to click out to on another layer. So it gives you the opportunity to chunk the content in a meaningful way. So here are your deboxify techniques. I had to make up that word. The important thing to keep in mind with this particular technique is what you're trying to do is improve the signal-to-noise ratio. You want the content to come out at the user and all that structure and the lines and the boxes and the chrome and stuff to recede. Last but not least, sweat the details. So the more dense your interface is, the more details you have, and details add up for better or for worse. So we're going to look at this site. I am going to have to speed through this just a little bit. So this is the USDA Plants website. You know, it's got a visible grid, but they're deviating from the grid in so many places that the whole design just has this kind of sloppy, haphazard feel. It just feels like it's a little out of control. Nobody's in charge of it. It feels a little lost. So I'm going to speed through these guys because these are just all the places where it's bad. Yeah, look at that. Empty bullet. That's weak. This stuff kills me. It's so unnecessary. You know, the problem is these deviations are small, but they really add up, and they can create a feeling of unease in the user. And when users start to become aware of that, they start to distrust the design, and by extension, your content. So this is a site that does this really well, New York Times. We talked about them earlier. They have a really beautiful adherence to their grid. There are beautiful details, like the fact that their comments icon, the baseline of the comments icon, lines up with the baseline of the comments text. It's like a print detail. People don't do this on the web. They have this gorgeous little chart in the middle. Even the bylines are formatted with intention. There's a painstaking attention to detail in this, and that's one of the things that gives this site authority. You can tell that somebody really loves this interface. Nothing is here by accident. Everything is done for a reason. And so by extension, you assume that the same rigor goes into their news gathering as well. So here's Plants database site. We're going to fix it up just bit by bit here. First thing we're going to do is align everything to the grid. And I'm actually doing this all the way across the page, not just in that little corner. So here's our original. These are small, subtle things, so I'm going to keep showing you the original. And then here's where we are now. We're going to make the spacing consistent in that navigation area. And again, I'm doing this all the way through. So here we are back in the beginning. Here we are now. Then we're going to really sweat the details. And what that means is you're going to go around and do a visual QA. We're going to fix any formatting issues. We're going to clean up the fonts and styles and make them consistent. We're going to clean up stray pixels and broken links and empty bullets and all that good stuff. So here we are back, original. And there we are. You can see these details really add up. I mean, I didn't do anything. I just moved stuff around. And, you know, this is not a great design, but at least now it's organized and rational. And, of course, if I'm feeling really perky, I could go ahead and fix the whole thing up. So more than anything else I've talked about, consistency and attention to detail are the keys to building trust. Because no matter how good your content is, if you have a sloppy interface, it's going to undermine the trust in that content. You really don't want to do that after you put in all that effort. Now, the beautiful thing about this is that you can pick any combination of these techniques and improve your site right away. And the best part is, almost everything I talked about today could be done in CSS. So if you have good IA and you have a site already built that has a good style sheet, you could walk out of here today and start implementing some of these fixes. So I tend to feel like these overweight interfaces are not going anywhere. I think we're all going to have to face up to them one of these days. I mean, sites and applications are more complex and have more features. Organizations and governments are putting more services and more operations on the web. Clients are more sophisticated and they expect a lot more out of their websites and applications. So we all need to learn how to deal with these heavy, overweight interfaces. But first we need to learn not to fear them, but to embrace them. So go on, give them a big old hug, even if you can't quite get your hands to meet on the other side. Thank you. You have 5 minutes? Oh, cool. Are there any questions?
Gotta use the microphone if you have a question.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Really, I guess all these sites, though, are informational sites?
Yes.
Can you talk just briefly about challenges using these principles in liposuctioning software interfaces and transactional applications?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I wanted to cover that, but I ran out of time. Also, it's actually harder to find examples to improve. The other problem is that it's really hard to do this kind of casual makeover on applications and transactional things, because you don't really know what they're trying to do. So it would have been more artificial. The things to keep in mind, first of all, as far as color goes, you're probably going to need more than one neutral base color. Like a lot of applications, designs that I do, we might have two or three base colors because we need different colors for different parts of the application, different tasks, and so on. The other thing is you might be limited in what accent color you can use because a lot of times special colors are reserved for things like error messaging or system messaging, so you might not be able to use red or yellow or something like that. As I said, you know, when you're doing a focus or trying to think about focus elements, you really need to focus in on tasks. You know, you want to make sure the design is providing a user with the information they need to do the task at hand and that they understand what's happening next, but that it's really clear when they get to that page, like, this is what I'm working on now. And that's really hard to do in a lot of these things, especially the kinds of, you know, really heavy data entry types of applications that have a lot of tables and things like that. So those are a couple of things that I think would apply to applications and transactional sites. Oh, right, the idea of boxes and stuff is super important in applications because I wanted to show some examples, but you know, a lot of applications have tons and tons of Chrome, especially like multi-pane interfaces. They've got all those sliders, and they've got all those tables and forms, and the forms all have bevels, and there's just like, ugh, it's terrifying. You can't even see where the labels are and stuff. So those are cases where it's really important to think about how to use color to tone all that stuff back and, you know, make the content come forward and make the structure in the Chrome kind of recede. Does that help?
Hi. My question is, how do you get buy-in from your, you know, HTML, CSS, front-end dev team? Because I've done a lot of this kind of design, and I've had arguments with the HTML people saying, yes, that 2 pixels of spacing, that really does matter.
Huh. Right. That's a good question. Usually, you know, I work pretty closely with my developers, and they're usually pretty good about working with designers. You know, they have experience doing that. So they do understand that, you know, designers are like, we're really uptight about those 2 pixels. So I think that it helps to show some things that are good and things that are bad. So, you know, if you looked at that New York Times site, I mean, one of the things that makes that so successful is the fact that they care about the 2 pixels. It really makes a huge difference. And so many sites are so sloppy and just so half-assed, you know. And I think that people can tell the difference. You know, users can tell the difference. And I think if you put examples like that in front of them and say, well, which one is better? You know, which one do you like better? And explain what makes it better. I think that might help. I hope that would help.
Hi. Great presentation. Thank you. I wondered about bringing analytics into design work, and when we find that, like, multi-feature slideshows, no one clicks past the first slide, or tabbed, layered content that people don't click on the other tabs, what your perspective is on that and, and their importance in design.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I'm not surprised, because I think that, you know, we put all this stuff in front of users and we think it's really important and we think they're going to think it's really important. So one of the things, that, you know, I think when I talk about the anchor element, I'm really talking about how to simplify it and put fewer choices in front of people. And, you know, the slideshow is a cop-out because you basically, you didn't decide. You just said, well, we have 10 things that we like. We're going to put them all up there and we're not going to choose for you what we think you should care about. So maybe that's a way to think about that is to, instead of just kind of copping out and saying, well, we could just put that in a tab box. You know, we don't have to decide which one we think people want to see. So maybe the thing to do would be to take your tab content and do like 3 tests, you know, do ABC test and see which one people like and then just use that one and then have a link that says more stuff over here. I don't know, maybe that would work. Are there more questions? Are we done?
No, you have one more, about 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you a huge question that can't possibly be answered in two
Great.
Minutes. So a lot of what you suggest is sort of your grounding, your foundation, sounds to me very print design based. The
right.
whole idea of creating hierarchy with a center of visual impact and then eye movement throughout the page. You don't really hear like eye movement coming up in web design conversations. So do you think print design has made the jump to the web, or do you think people act like, well, I don't need anything about print design. They just want to do PDFs. That's, you know, let me leave that behind. I
mean, yeah.
What do you think the value of it?
That's a softball, Dan. I mean, I come from print design, so of course I have total bias in favor of typography and, you know, layout and stuff like that. So has print made the jump to web? I think that what's happening is that because we have these complex interfaces and we're trying to do a lot more with content, we care more about content, we are naturally going and looking back at print techniques because print designers have been doing this forever. Like, they have all the techniques. We don't have to reinvent them. We just have to go and see, well, how do people do newsletters? I mean, a lot of these sites, these dense sites are essentially like a newsletter. You have a ton of stuff. You're trying to cram it in there. It changes all the time. And, you know, if any of you were ever print designers who had to do newsletters, you know that as soon as you hand the newsletter off to the client, it just falls apart. Like, they have no idea how to do this. It's complicated. So did that answer your question, sort of? Do we have time for one more? No. Okay, we're done. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2011 IA Summit. For more great user experience design content, visit UIE.com and sign up for our free newsletter, UIE Tips.